episode 169 of the Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today during this special week of people who actually have a real connection to the actual escape is Tony Hoskins, aircraft engineer. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Hi, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Looking forward to listening to all of your little anecdotes that you might have about the real story. I mean, we've been talking for 34 weeks about the movie itself. Today we'll obviously discuss a little bit about the movie, but the most important thing this week is to get some of the real stories so that our listeners can get more of an idea of what really happened. I mean, the Hollywood aspect of it is great, but we all know that there is more to it than that. So I hope that you'll be able to enlighten us a little bit. So minute 169 begins with Strachwitz hearing another car approaching and goes all the way till we get to see Von Luger entering a car as he's watched by Ramsey and company. As we were discussing yesterday, Gestapo basically showed up and they've walked into Von Luger's office area. We're not quite sure 100% what they're about to say or do or anything like that because everything happens inside and we don't get to see that. We only get to see what happens on the outside. While Strachwitz is standing there waiting by the front door, he seems to hear a car approaching and takes a look. I see another staff car come in. I like the way that it skids as it's making that turn. It looks like someone who really is in a rush to get rid of his cargo or whoever's inside. You know, we don't know. And at this point, we see that the car then swerves again and makes a quick stop right in front of the hut where Strachwitz is standing on the outside. Then we see the driver get out, also hastily. And then right behind him, we get to see Hiltz, Steve McQueen, getting out of the car. He's got his hands handcuffed. But as always, he's got that big smile on his face. It's one of the things that they're never able to wipe off of his face in this movie. I mean, I found it interesting that he actually gets to ride back in style. You know, we saw how the rest of them all came back, you know, disheveled in a back of a truck or whatever it is, and he gets his first-class ticket all the way back.
Well, I mean, largely, his arrival is probably slightly more accurate with regards to the original events, but he definitely arrives in style.
Why do you think it's why do you think it's more accurate?
Well, so, I mean, when you read the reports, most of the guys who had been captured were held at just one prison. And they were taken back in small numbers, mostly in German staff cars. So there's a couple of reports of lorries collecting groups of men at the time, but they were being taken off to be murdered. So
remind me what a lorry is. A lorry is a truck.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. Yes, of course.
No,
yes,
that's okay. It's my Americanisms. Sorry.
Yeah. So as you saw the other guys arrive earlier in the film and they're getting out the back of a truck, or even right back to the start of the film with the trucks turning up and churning them all out at the beginning, largely those that were taken off to be murdered were taken off in groups later on. The very early ones to be murdered were taken in pairs, but later on they were taken in groups of sort of three and four at a time.
To be more efficient?
Who knows? But, you know, as you then get later, because the film obviously condenses down an awful lot of things that happened in over a number of weeks, which they portray almost within days.
Right.
So to have an individual turn up in the car, particularly once all the announcements have been made about how many people have been shot, is far more accurate. So yes, in this instance, that's probably, whilst his hurried arrival is probably a little bit over the top.
Maybe they were just trying to rush it because they knew that they were coming in at 172 minutes. So, you know, you might as well rush the scene a little bit to try and cut out maybe a minute or so.
Potentially, but you know, it's got Steve McQueen in the car, so it's...
He's not driving.
No, but he was a speed man, wasn't he? So
yes.
Yeah. But no, it's. I think that's probably a fairly accurate representation of how reasonably individuals would have been brought back.
Oh, wow. So basically you're saying that Steve McQueen sitting in the back screaming at the stunt driver to go faster, faster. You're not going fast enough. Make a skid. Go this way. Who knows?
Well, I think the guys, I think it was very unknown what their fates were. Most of them were expecting to be taken back to a camp, but obviously this was a very different situation. I suspect the air around a lot of things was different to previous escape attempts they'd had. So, but yeah, I think individuals coming back or in pairs in a car at a time is probably fairly closer to reality than the rest of the film would make out.
Okay. That's great to know. Okay. So basically, Hiltz gets out of the car, and then if you pay close attention, the officer that gets out right behind him actually hits his head as he's walking out. Maybe he's a stormtrooper in Star Wars also. Actor. I don't know if are you familiar with that? That in Star Wars, there's a scene where stormtroopers are walking through a door, and the door isn't pulled up high enough, and one of them actually bumps his head. The actor bumps his head.
But I do like a good Star Wars film, but I get more immersed in the story and miss the finer details.
Yeah. Well, when you're watching a movie a minute by minute, you sort of notice details a little bit better.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah, right. At this point, then we see the Commandant's door open up, and Von Luger exits. Does not look very happy, obviously, and a number of people behind him. So we see Posen come out, but Posen is preceded by Steiner, the SS officer, who comes out and then he looks at him. And at this point, we get to see that Strachwitz salutes Von Luger, and then Steiner actually says he's not to be saluted. He's no longer in command. Now, I mean, that's a little strange from my perspective, because the whole phrase of respect the rank, not the man. You know, if someone has a particular rank, you still are going to salute them, even if they no longer are in command.
So yes, indeed.
It's a little strange for them to say that. If you were to say that he's been stripped of his rank, that's another thing. But to say he's no longer in command, as far as I'm concerned, as I know, and I mean, I'm not a military expert, but based on what I know, that I think that's more just for the dramatic effect at this point.
Yeah, because I think the whole thing's trying to lead up to suggesting an outcome that's likely to happen, but we know in reality wasn't true. It didn't come to fruition. But obviously, it's right near the end of the film. The audience is trying to think what's going to happen. Is punishment? It's Germany. You know, are they going to bring apart some particularly harsh?
Are they going to execute him or not? Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the film is done in a way to try and let the audience come to their own conclusion,
right?
Without actually suggesting anything. So,
right. Based on what I know, in reality, he wasn't executed, and he was just stripped of his command. And then I think he actually ended up later on being put on trial for war crimes.
So he actually, again, like I say, the film try and condenses down weeks of what happened. So obviously the Gestapo did arrive at the camp after the escape, and everything was looked into. And I think actually von Lindner was pulled up for some sort of there was some sort of black market deal going on with food, etc. When they started to really investigate what was going on between the commandant and the camp guards and everything else. And that's the only thing they could really pull him up for. But it was
you mean that butter that they found earlier on?
Well, yes and no. I think the real von Lindner, so obviously he's Luger in the film and Lindner in real life. You know, he was not a fan of the Nazi movement at all. He was very sympathetic. I mean, you've got a decorated and several times wounded officer from the First World War who moreover joined up in the Second World War through necessity rather than anything else. So, you know, he was in a sympathetic position with the prisoners at the camp. But obviously, you know, it's been a major security breach with the fact that so many have gone out. Hitler's obviously very upset about it all, sends the people in to try and see if there's, you know, how can this camp is supposedly, you know, you can't escape from it, so how have all these people got out? And it was over a period of weeks that they looked at him, and eventually, yes, he was relieved of his command. And I think he actually ended up commanding a unit of soldiers in the defense of Sagan with the Russians advancing, and then he ended up surrendering to the British. I think he testified at the trials that went on afterwards, and he ended up being locked up in London for several years, so we didn't actually let him go out of prison until I think about 1947, I think he was interned in the UK for. So, you know, we held on to him for a while. And then obviously he died just before the film actually came out. So in real life, he never got to see the film.
I'm not sure that that's something he would have wanted to relive.
Well, yeah, I mean, but you say that. I mean, there were people, you know, in the history of films, if you're talking about the Colditz film as well, there were people who were ex-prisoners that were all involved with this. There were ex-prisoners involved with, obviously, the Hollywood version of The Great Escape.
Yeah, and, of course.
You know, whilst it meanders a little bit from it, I think actually the film is, if you were to show it to people who don't know the story, they will get the crux of what happened the finer detail is lost amongst certain things. But, you know, it all relates to certain people. Some of the characters are combinations of a number of different individuals, mm-hmm. but it gets right. the story over in, what, 170 minutes?
172 minutes.
To people who don't necessarily know or understand the story. Right. So in that aspect, I think it does a good job of what it needs to do.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Continuing along with this, actually, I wanted to ask you, have you ever seen the pseudo-sequel to this movie?
I have not, actually, but I believe in that one,
they actually shoot him.
Yeah, exactly. I believe it is, yeah. But no, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it at all.
Okay, because that one is much closer to the real events. I mean, they use the real names also. You know, you have Roger Bushell instead of Roger Bartlett, and you know you have John Dodge. Was his name John? The Artful Dodger. Well, this is I thought it was John.
I think so, yeah, right. I think, yeah.
Right. So he's if you get a chance, I mean it's a little bit longer than this movie. It's actually 3 hours long, but it's also fascinating. It's not as good as this. It's not as Hollywood. It's much darker. But there they spend a lot more time on the events after the escape.
Right.
You know?
Yes. Like I say, it's very compressed in the Hollywood film.
Correct.
You know, you're talking of three to four weeks worth of timeline spread seemingly in about 48 hours.
Yeah.
So,
if you're only talking about the escape. We're not even talking about the digging. I mean, the digging, we all know it took about 9 months to do all the digging, even though they had to stop for part of the winter because of the weather and stuff like that. You know, the way that the movie depicts it, it takes just like a month or two. Or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
And also they let them go out in the middle of the summer.
Yeah, it's always summer. It's selling the three of the films.
There's never winter. So at this point, we get this. Von Luger then takes a look at Steinek after he says this, and then he looks over and he sees Steve McQueen. You know, he sees Hiltz actually showing up, and then Hiltz gives him a very interesting look. He's somewhat amazed at what actually is going on here. And if you pay attention, there's a guard right behind him that has this really, really funny look on his face because his eyes are shifting back and forth. You know, I guess it's just an extra that didn't know where he was supposed to look at the time because he's trying to look everywhere but at the camera. So it's pretty funny. And then we see Von Luger walking down the steps towards Hiltz. And then we get a short little conversation between Hiltz and Von Luger where Hiltz says, "Well, the job just didn't work out for you, huh?" Which, you know, his nice American or Steve McQueen cynicism the whole way. And then Von Luger says, "You were lucky, Hiltz." And then Hiltz says, "Lucky? Because I didn't." And then you see it just hits him. He realizes what happened. He realizes that a lot of them didn't get back. And he goes, "How many?" And, you know, you see a somewhat somber look on his face because he understands that he really is lucky about what happened. And Von Luger then responds, 50. And then at this point, after he says 50, we see that Steinach looks at him and looks at him in a very disapproving manner that, you know, maybe you're not supposed to be discussing what actually happened. And then Von Luger says to Hiltz, you know, anyone who remembers their first conversation many, many months ago when we discussed this, so where Hiltz said that he's planning on seeing Berlin before Von Luger. So Von Luger's line at this point is, it takes us back to that early scene. "It looks, after all, as if you will see Berlin before I do." And then we get a reassuring face on Hiltz because he knows what's probably in store for Von Luger. As you discussed earlier, you know, they're giving the impression that he's about to be taken off and shot somewhere. Even though he's just given, in real life, as you mentioned, he's given a lesser detail to take a, something, you know, with a, I guess a lot less responsibility. You know, you don't have to look over 600 prisoners.
Yeah, of course.
And at this point, Von Luger then walks towards the car, and then they open up the staff car. You know, so we get to see the interesting way. I always find it really funny the staff cars that have just two doors, where you have to move the seat in order for everyone to get into the back seat. You know, that's something that's rare. I mean, growing up in the 80s, I remember that there were cars that you did have that. But nowadays, it's very rare that you're going to have a car where you have to pull the seat back.
Oh, really? Oh, no, on this side of the water, dear boy, it's really common. I've got a Mercedes with exactly
really?
That now. That's not very old. Yeah, two door. Yeah, it's a common thing on this side of the water.
Okay, I guess I'm just talking out of my ass again.
no, it's fairly common. We don't have doors anymore that hinge at the B post and open forward. We don't have suicide doors anymore. We do have quite a number of cars where, yeah, you get in the back via the front. So
okay, all right. So I guess I'm just used to four door sedans. as opposed to two doors. All right, it happens.
But it's interesting what you're saying. He said, I mean, that little bit, that little conversation, I think is very much probably a play to Steve McQueen, really, because, you know, it's suggesting that he is knowledgeable from the commandant's attitude that, you know, people have been shot or have not survived the escape attempt. You've got to realise at that point in 1944, there had been a lot of escapes by then, but there had never really been reprisals. People had been killed whilst escaping, but that was normally, I mean, for Sinclair at Colditz, for example, he was shot whilst trying to run away. Because obviously they were trying to shoot him to slow him down, disable him, etc. And they shot and killed him. At that point, prisoners of war had not been shot post-capture as retribution for their actual escape. So if you had escaped and not been shot actually as part of that process of getting out of the camp, then normally you would be returned often to a different camp, but quite possibly to the camp that you had just escaped from. So, you know, it would be fairly unknown or fairly wide of the mark to have prior knowledge that the likelihood of people escaping if you hadn't actually been shot getting out the tunnel, which Hiltz would have known because he was there at the tunnel exit, wasn't he, at the in the film, you know, then he would have known that, you know, lots had got away beforehand and hadn't been shot. So, you know, it's leading on to something, you know, it was unheard of. The retribution for this escape attempt was unprecedented. And, you know, subsequently, notes went around to camp saying, you know, the tide has changed. They're ignoring the Geneva Convention. You know, you are likely to end up in a lot of trouble, even if you are not shot just getting out the camp. So probably best not to do it, which was the effect that the Germans wanted, really, because it ties up huge amounts of manpower. But so I think it was a little play to Steve McQueen there for ensuring that he was more knowledgeable about the risks involved with escaping than possibly in real life that would have been on the minds of those who were doing it.
Hey, if it works, why not?
Yeah, exactly.
If it's able to deliver to the audience what they want to deliver, then I guess that works out.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Right. And then to end off the minute, basically we see von Luger sit down in the car, and then Steinich then joins him and sits down in the car, and then we get to see a shot of Ramsey and a whole bunch of the other prisoners just looking on as they're getting into the car. And that's pretty much how this minute ends. But our story is not over at that point, because the reason that we have you here, Tony, like we've had all our other guests this week, is to actually give us more insight and information about the real story of what happened in Stalaglyph 3. So first of all, why don't you tell people, what is your connection? What's your fascination with this story? If there is a connection, I mean, I know there is, but...
It actually starts when I was really young, so I obviously never saw the film the first time round because it came out almost 20 years before I was born. So it's not it wasn't something that I could get to see in the cinema.
I think I've had one guest the entire time that was old enough to see it in the theater.
Really? So, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. No. So I missed
you're in good company with that.
That's right. But I mean, traditionally over here, you know, The Great Escape was like Christmas Day, Boxing Day. You know, viewing, it was always on the TV.
Bank holiday.
Yeah. I mean, so it's I don't want to say it's an institution type film, but, you know, everybody knows The Great Escape film is something you watch on the holidays sort of thing. So, yeah, so I'd seen it from, you know, being a little boy, etc. And I'd grown up in rural Oxfordshire and, yeah, always been fascinated with history and everything. I wind the clock on by 30 years. And nowadays I'm fortunate enough to restore Spitfires and aeroplanes from this era for a living. And I've been writing books and other bits and pieces. But about 3 years ago, nearly 4 years ago, actually, I found and located a Spitfire that had actually been flown by one of those people who was in The Great Escape. And he was one of the men that was executed as a result of the getting out of the camp. And I didn't know very much about him. His name was Sandy Gunn. You looked him up and he was listed as a name as one of the 50. But there was very little else about this one man. So I set out, having found his aeroplane, to research his life and find out what his story was.
Okay, I want to stop you for 1 second. How did you find his airplane? If he was shot down, his airplane should have, you know, exploded or something, didn't it?
Well, I went looking for it because, you know, the thing was, I was trying to... We celebrated in 2018, 100 years of the Royal Air Force. Okay. And I was working with a documentary filmmaker to make a documentary about 100 years of the Royal Air Force. And over here, the Spitfire is really iconic. So we said, let's try and tell a little bit about Spitfire. But what you get with these stories is you get, if you have like granddads or great-granddads that were in the war, and you'd go and talk to one great-granddad about a particular event, and he'd tell you one story. Perfectly true. But you can go and talk to another granddad about the same event and tell you a totally different story. Again, perfectly true. And you keep on going on. You've got lots and lots of stories, which makes it very difficult to sum up an entire event. So I thought, Ferrari F100, let's find an item that has lots of stories attached to it. And that item has to be an aeroplane because it's RAF 100. And the Spitfire is so incredibly well known across anybody in the street. You can walk along the street and say, here's a picture of Concorde, here's a picture of a 747, here's a picture of a Spitfire. They'll generally be able to tell you what it is. So I said, let's go and find a Spitfire that has lots of stories attached to it. But there aren't Spitfires just lying around waiting to be found.
Oh, there aren't?
No, you know. So, you know, you're almost sort of 70 years after the war and you're trying to find a Spitfire. So most of the ones have been dug up that are in the UK and France and Germany. So you start to look into Scandinavia, where it's a bit more remote, a bit more difficult to get to. And obviously all of the losses are published. So I sat at our public records office in London for months going through all of the losses to try and see what had been lost in sort of Norway and Sweden that had a story attack. And I came across this photographic reconnaissance Spitfire, so they'd been flying unarmed, so they didn't have any guns to protect themselves, and the name Sandy Gunn was next to it, prisoner of war, and then died whilst a prisoner of war. Hence why I then looked him up. He was listed as one of the 50. I thought, my word, there's an incredible story behind that. But his part was not known. It was just born in Scotland, murdered in Poland. So you then start to look through the rest of it, and I found all these incredible people who had flown this same aeroplane. There were racing drivers, there were jockeys, there were people from across the whole Commonwealth.
Before him.
So these basically five guys had all gone up to Scotland to hunt for the Tirpitz, and they'd all flown this one aeroplane. So I had all these stories that tied in. And I could research a lot of them because the racing driver was really well known and the Grand National winning jockey was really well known. But Sandy Gunn still wasn't. So I then threw myself into researching all about the Great Escape. I had his diaries. I had his letters from the camp back home and correspondence that was going backwards and forwards and the packages that his roommates had put together to send back to his family. And then I started reaching out to other families of people who had been in the Great Escape to try and piece together the story of his life in the camp, because he was the fifth prisoner to arrive in Stalaglav 3. It was a brand new camp.
Wow.
So he was there right the way through the whole thing. And, you know, he'd started off digging Tunnel Tom, which obviously was a tunnel that had been discovered. And he'd been involved with the security and a couple of other bits and pieces around the camp. He was quite good at making cafetieres for doing coffee. So everyone seemed to go to him from the camp for doing that. And because he was Scottish and the Red Cross used to send across porridge oats, they used to go to the Scotsman to make up their porridge oats properly with the clim that they got from the German rations. So it was really interesting, you know, just to get his story and put it together over the course of his time there. But sadly, there was very little. When you go through all the hundreds of thousands of pages of documents on the investigation of the murder, there was very little that they could find out about him, because of course the Russians had gone through. It was several years later. And most people either wouldn't talk or weren't around to talk anymore about what happened. So sadly, of all of the cases that were brought against people that they could find, they couldn't attribute Sandy Gunn to any particular German officer who pulled the trigger. Widely speculated that we know who it was, but there was no evidence of that at the time. And, you know, so it unfortunately, sadly, remains a mystery. But
oh, wow.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's been amazing to research. It's been nearly 4 years of my life now researching this one man and his time in the camp and what happened to him. And, you know, we found his family and distant family. And I've spoken to lots of families of great escapers. I wrote to the last two great escapers when they were still alive. Both sadly declined an interview because at that point in their lives, they were saying it was pretty bad. We don't really want to go there. They're memories from a long time ago. So respectfully, we'll decline the opportunity for a talk, which I totally respect. I get that. But yeah, it was very sad that when those last two gentlemen passed away, I thought information that only they know, that I would give anything to find out about what it was like in that room that night as they were just about to go.
And they never discussed it with their children? that you could get that information from their children. Obviously, not from the direct source, but it's still as close as you're going to get.
There are some historical television interviews from about 20 years ago, but they don't go into the detail. For example, I found several reports that put together to say that, you know, you see the collapse in the tunnel, don't you? When they're going through and the big bag knocks it and it knocks a bit of the tunnel and they have to go.
That doesn't happen in the movie, but it happened in the original script and it happened in real life with Cedric's, or the character named Cedric. You know, he had this big valise that caused the cave-in in the middle. We discussed it when it happened because that scene wasn't filmed or was cut out.
Well, this is it. So yes. Sandy Gunn, there was a report that Sandy Gunn was in a tunnel collapse that night and had to be pulled out and dug out of the tunnel collapse. So, you know, it's really interesting for me because their places all moved around in the tunnel to trying to work out who was where and what and in which order they were, because Sandy Gunn was number 68 in theory to get out, and his friend Hubert was 80, but Hubert wasn't in the tunnel when it was discovered. So 76 had gone, he should have been in the tunnel, but he wasn't. So they were all moving around their positions. It was somewhat chaotic that night, but you know, we really want
I wonder why.
Yes, but I really want to find out because, you know, I've just got one written report from Tony Bethel, who was a great escaper, who said that no, Sandy was involved in a tunnel collapse going out that night and had to be dug out. Didn't say why. Was it a bag? Was it an elbow? Was it just the people going through? I will never sadly know. And that's quite heavy. So
then how did you find his plane?
So simply having located that, Google is a wonderful thing. You put in the registration of the aeroplane and see how many people have been talking about it. And there was a note to say that a microlite club, you know, not far away, had some bits hanging on the wall in their clubhouse. And a few other people had looked for it. But, you know, there was no record of this aeroplane having turned up anywhere. It wasn't in a museum. The Ministry of Defence, UK Ministry of Defence, hadn't had a confirmation that the aeroplane had been recovered apart, you know, during all of their post-war searches for things. So I thought, well, maybe it's there. And I ended up writing to the locals in this town, which was where Sandy was captured. And I ended up going out there. They knew where there were some bits of wreckage that, you know, people over the years would say there's an aeroplane crashed up there. And in the end, we got all of the elders together in the village with coffee and cake and sat them all down and said, right, talk about it. And, you know, there were three or four people who had witnessed the shoot down and witnessed the crash who could tell the story. And we slowly pieced it all together as to roughly where it was. And then we went and did a lot of walking around hills looking for bits of metal sticking out the ground. And, there was basically 70% of the aeroplane sitting in a bog on the side of this mountain. So I came back to the UK, put together some colleagues, and we went out about a month later, 10 of us and a load of people from the town, and we spent a week digging it out the peat bog and carrying it down the mountain piece by piece, because you couldn't get a truck up there. There were no helicopters. The helicopters are 100 miles away and involved in you know, mountain rescue and stuff like that, so you don't tie them up for picking up bits of Spitfire off a hill. But yeah, got everything apart from the tail section, because the tail section had come off when it had been shot down. But yeah, both wings, the fuselage, the engine, lots of it, and that's now all slowly being rebuilt to fly again.
What percentage of the plane would you say has been rebuilt?
Well, we got 70% of a Spitfire out of the ground. It's a bit difficult to say yet as to how much will be in, because, for example, we've got both wings, which are crushed but largely intact. The fuselage burnt quite heavily, and the engine obviously got pushed back into it. But we've recovered quite a lot of items from the fuselage, particularly the lower fuselage, because if you imagine we've sat in the Spitfire, everything from your bum down we recovered. But everything up from that is all really lightweight. So whilst it's there, it's paper thin or it's corroded. But every fuselage frame we've got has got some parts that are original in it. And what we have spent a lot of time doing is recovering other parts that are original. So on the fuselage side, probably about 10 to 15% of the fuselage is original AA-810 Sandy Spitfire. But then all of the rest of the systems that I've got are original systems. So I've got original rudder pedals, original control column, original hydraulic selector for the gear. I've just got an original throttle unit. We've got all original instrumentation. So overall, probably about 40 or 45% of the fuselage, whilst it won't all be original AA-810, it will be original wartime build material with some structure around it. And, you know, we're now just coming up to 2 years into the build, and we've got a completely brand new back end because we didn't find the original back end, but I put original equipment into the back end. So it's got some original Spitfire stuff in it. And we're now working on the fuselage all the way through to the back of the engine. We've got an engine that's being worked on because the original engine shattered when it hit the ground. But then I've got an original propeller unit that's come out of a Battle of Britain Spitfire. That will go onto the front because obviously Sandy's one is a bit bent. So it's a bit difficult to straighten that. But we've got an original Battle of Britain propeller unit going on the front, and we're about to start work on the wings soon. So there's a lot of work to bust down the original Sandy Spitfire wings, and we'll see what's reusable out of that to go from there. We'll have to put brand new main spars in it because it's a safety, flight safety item. That everything else, plus of course it's got a great big cannon shell through one of the spars, so that doesn't work. But we'll reuse as much of the wings as we can as well.
Wow, and the expectation is that eventually this will be able to fly, or just to have it in the museum?
So we're hoping it will fly towards the end of 2023 or early 2024. That's the hope. So it's all a factor of money and time. And the more money you have, the quicker it will happen. The less money you have, the longer it will happen. But we're getting there steadily.
Oh, wow. Very cool. Now, have you read Brickhill's book?
I read it an awful long time ago, and it is slightly more detailed and closer to things of the film, in my
opinion. No, obviously. Yeah. I mean, in anyone's opinion. You know, and also obviously it was written much closer to when it happened, and you know the movie is somewhat based on the events that were as they were played out in the book. Now, do you know if Sandy Gunn is mentioned in the book at all?
Yes, he is. Yeah, his name appears once in the book. Yeah.
Yes, I was just about to tell you. I just found his name. So yeah, I was testing you.
Yes.
I was testing to see how much research you really did on this.
Yes, I have pretty much every book that you can find that's in English. There are several books that I know a chap who's having one translated at the moment. There's a very good Polish book about the Great Escape and Sargon, and I'm very looking forward to reading that translation when it comes out. But,
so do you remember what passage Gunn is mentioned in the book, in that one passage?
Oh, God, now you're testing me. Go on, read it to me.
Basically, it's after they were all captured. So it says, on April 6th, Lux...
Oh, is it being threatened with being beheaded?
No. Lux took another six from Gorlitz, Grisman, Gunn, J.F. Williams, Milford, Street, and McGar. They were cremated at Breslau, but it was not until April 13th that Lux took Cookie Long from Gorlitz. His urn shows that he was cremated at Breslau. So basically, the only mention of Sandy Gunn in the book is the date of when he was apparently shot, which was April 6th.
Yes, that's correct. So now we've got... So I've got letters from Tony Bethel that calls of the order that they were taken away. In that time as well, there's another book. I'm trying to remember the author who wrote that one, but two of them, including Sandy Gunn, were threatened with being beheaded during their interrogations.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there's lots of stories that come around, because what they did do, the guys, when they were all in their prison room, and you see it to an extent in the film, they're all put together in one sort of like dungeon type space. And they know to each other. Well, from the letters we've got, they all told their individual stories to each other of their escape stories, which is why we know a bit more, because particularly those that survived came back.
Knew the story.
Wrote to the families of those who had been murdered.
Mm.
So Sandy Gunn's family actually collected four or five different sets of letters from four or five different prisoners who had been on the escape, who had been recaptured, who then were saying, look, I was in prison with your son. He told me X, Y, and Z, which is why we managed to piece together some more of the information.
And but do you know how he got captured?
We think we do. So he didn't speak German, and he was escaping. His escape partner was Mike Casey, who also didn't speak German. And basically, the report that we have is that they felt that if they had to travel by train, they had to, but they were likely to be caught sooner or later if they traveled in the train. So Gunn and Casey travelled underneath the trains, sitting on the bogies, amongst the wheels, under the train tracks to travel. Now, the report we've got, there's a lot saying, they were captured just down the road, but he was actually on the run for nearly 48 hours. And we've got some reports of them being caught up near Sassnitz, up in the top of Germany. Now, to have got there, they'd have had to take a train into Germany and then back out of Germany to head up to the ports. And the area that we've been given as a potential area that they were captured, which was suggested by one of the other prisoners, because they mentioned that they had been, that prisoner had been captured the day after two other guys caught at the railway site. So what we think was happening is they were possibly transferring at the railway sidings from one train to another, try and get up to the port, were challenged and obviously couldn't speak any German, so were caught. So that's what we think happened with both of those
gentlemen. Oh, wow. Fascinating. All right. Do you have anything else you want to enlighten us about?
No, I think you know, if your followers are interested in knowing more about what we're doing, then if they have a look at, if they can, they can Google for Sandy Spitfire or Spitfire AA810. And that will take you to the website where we've got good social media presence and everything else on rebuilding Sandy Spitfire. And as we find out information about him, we put it out there. And there is a book on his life, which is titled Sandy Spitfire, which they can get, which we're working on the next edition, which will have the final story of the restoration of all his aeroplane. At the moment, it finishes at the point that we find the aeroplane and we find the nephew of Sandy Gunn. But we'll release the next book in 2024, 2025, which will have all the story of the restoration as well. But yeah, we're out there if they want to find out more about Sandy.
Wow, very cool. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about the movie and also talk about the real story. It was very enlightening for me. Hopefully our listeners also felt the same way.
No problem at all.
And if they want to get in touch with you personally, what's the best way?
They can get me through the website. We've got a generic info@spitfireaa810.co.uk that will go into our main server, and then I can pick it up from there. So, yeah, I'm within 2 to 4 hours of any email contact if people want to get in touch.
Very cool. All right. And anyone that's listening, if you go, please rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher they might be listening to this show on. You can send us an email, thegreatminute@gmail.com. Our website is thegreatescapeminute.com. Our Facebook group is The Cooler, and our Twitter account is GreatEscapeMXM. So until tomorrow, where we will have another fascinating story about the real events. Tally-ho!
Tally-ho, Rob.